Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's program, we learn about one physician's personal battle with dengue fever.
2 years ago, dengue was introduced in Key West, Florida. The first outbreak was about 120 patients. Now every year it's coming back. It's now within the mosquito population.
Plus, efforts to promote diversity in the healthcare workforce.
When you look at healthcare statistics and the disparity of healthcare of underrepresented populations, what we have to do is to begin from the ground up.
And how an emphasis on rural medicine training is helping bring physicians back to small town practices.
We also try to connect with the folks from the area to serve and go back to their hometown.
We'll get a checkup from the neck up and hear a selection from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we take a look at efforts to promote diversity in our healthcare workers, plus how a training emphasis on rural medicine is bringing more doctors back to a small town country practices. But first, one local physician's battle with dengue fever. Dengue fever. It sounds exotic, more like something out of an Indiana Jones movie than something we might hear of in central New York or in the United States for that matter. But dengue fever, a viral infection, is usually found in the tropics and that affects more than 50 million people worldwide each year, has returned to the continental U.S. And to date, there is no cure. Joining us with more on this is Dr. Timothy Endy, Chief of Infectious Diseases and Associate Professor of Medicine at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Endy.
Thanks very much for having me.
So let's start with what is the disease? What is dengue fever? I also saw it was sometimes called breakbone fever.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
Well, dengue is it's a viral infection. So it's a virus, a very small, what we call an RNA virus. And it occurs as four different types, which we call creatively dengue 1, 2, 3, and 4. And they're very, very close cousins to each other, and they're known as the family of the group of dengue virus that's in the family flavivirus.
Flavivirus.
Mm-hmm. Flavi being Latin for yellow for the sort of the progenitor virus, which is yellow fever virus.
So in some ways it's related to the yellow fever
it's
virus?
It's a cousin.
It's like a variant?
Mm-hmm. And the flaviviruses themselves have some very important viruses, including one that we're very familiar with in New York State, West Nile virus.
So that's another relative.
Right, another relative. So there's some characteristics that they all share, which the most important being that they're all mosquito-borne viruses. So dengue viruses, dengue 1, 2, 3, and 4, are spread by a mosquito virus. And when a person is infected and getting, you know, bitten by an infected mosquito and then infected, there is usually a 3 to 7 day, what we call an incubation period, where the virus is replicating, but you don't know that you're infected. And then you develop the classic symptoms of chills and muscle aches, fever, and then the degree of muscle aches or the bone pain that is experienced classifies it as a kind of a break bone. So patients who are ill describe it as being, I've got the breakbone fever. And that was really initiated during a very large outbreak in Philadelphia during the 1700s.
Oh, wow.
And Dr. Benjamin Rush described that very well with his ladies calling it a breakbone fever.
So then in some ways the bones were feeling like they were breaking because
exactly.
They were so painful.
Exactly.
I see. That explains that whole terminology. So how serious is it? I mean, let me just back up. So it's borne by mosquitoes, and mm-hmm. you can only get it by being bitten by a mosquito that's carrying it.
Correct.
It doesn't get transmitted human to human.
It does not.
Okay.
So there's no human to human transmission. It's a human mosquito, and then the mosquito, if it's not infected but feeds on a person who does have the dengue virus, becomes infected itself.
So that mosquito is the vector kind of that continues
exactly.
that that whole connection.
Right.
So, how serious is it? I mean,
well, the what we call serotypes, basically the four types of dengue, is important because if you get infected to one of the types, you are basically protected for life, but you can still get infected to the other three. So if you have the misfortune of getting all four infections, then you'll be basically protected after you've received those four infections. The first infection is known as dengue fever, where you develop the fevers and the chills and you're quite ill for 3 to 4 days. And then you have some fatigue, the fever goes away, and it actually resolves pretty well. And there is no mortality associated with it. On your second infection, however, the first infection sort of sets up, sort of primes you for developing a very severe form of dengue infection on your second infection.
So there's just let me get this straight. Mm-hmm. So regardless of what serotype you're infected with, the first incident of any infection, basically you can recover from fairly readily, you said.
That's right.
But what it does is set up maybe an immune reaction.
Correct.
That will be more intensified, much like an allergic kind of reaction, the second time.
Exactly. And not everyone will experience that, but your risk for developing the severe form is 100-fold than if you hadn't had the second infection. And this particular severe form is called dengue hemorrhagic fever. And it's a typical hemorrhagic-producing virus, very similar to yellow fever, maybe not as severe as Ebola, but certainly in terms of the same kind of immune reaction that causes such severity, there's some very common pathways.
So when you say hemorrhagic, mm-hmm. help us understand what happens in the body.
So you develop very high fever. You develop your liver enzymes are damaged to the liver. But more importantly, the inner lining of your blood vessels becomes damaged. So it leaks the fluid from inside the blood vessels to the outside.
So you're bleeding within.
You're bleeding within, and you lose fluid within so that you can go into to shock pretty quickly, in fact, pretty rapidly over an hour or so. In addition, those factors in your blood that help you to clot blood, like when you get a cut, are consumed, so you develop a bleeding disorder. And those platelets, which also help you to clot blood, also drop to a dangerous level. So you can have pretty massive bleeding as well. That's why we call it a hemorrhagic fever.
So basically, in the second go-around, it's potentially life-threatening.
Well, it is potentially life-threatening, and if not treated appropriately, 10 out of 100 people can die from it.
Wow. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Timothy Endy, and we're talking about dengue fever. So it can be that serious, especially if it's the second time around. There's no cure, so what kind of treatment is offered?
It's what we call supportive therapy, which means that you recognize the drop in the blood pressure, so you give them fluid replacements to get their blood pressure back up. If they're bleeding internally into the gastrointestinal tract, then you replace their volume with blood products and basically support them through the crisis, which can last up to 72 hours. And as you get the patient through that, then their survivability becomes pretty certain.
So basically, with the right care, even that second, more serious form can be supported.
Yeah, with appropriate care, and Thailand is a great example of this because they've been dealing with this for almost since the 1950s. They have entire wards set up to treat hemorrhagic fever, and they have a very specific treatment guidelines. And their mortality has gone down to less than, one death per 1,000 patients.
So you, I know that, well, let me ask you this first. It's kind of resurged mm-hmm. in the United States, where it had been, as you said, in the 1700s, there had been outbreaks. And then we kind of had eliminated it. It's mm-hmm. back in the United States now. In what numbers? I mean, where is it mostly?
Well, Mexico has had a long problem with dengue. In fact, they had a large outbreak this year. So there's been dengue introduced into Texas along the Mexico border since the 1990s, and they've been sort of limited outbreaks. What we have going for us in the United States is this very magical instrument called the window screen. And the window screen is a very effective barrier for keeping a lot of these mosquitoes out. Of course, if you go outside and have a picnic or you're sitting outside, you're still susceptible to biting. But, you know, we in the United States have an infrastructure that sort of limits our exposure for a high degree, unlike poorer nations that don't have window screens. So Texas had a very limited outbreak. 2 years ago, dengue was introduced in Key West, Florida. And that has actually spread. The first outbreak was about 120 patients that became quite ill. And now every year it's coming back. It's now within the mosquito population. So there's been several hundred cases. In fact, I saw a patient who was hospitalized at a hospital here in Syracuse who got dengue from Key West, Florida.
Wow. So should we in Central New York worry, I guess?
Well, there's a lot of things to worry about.
Well, I mean specifically about dengue.
You know, I wouldn't, you know, have your eyes wide open at night staring at the ceiling worrying about dengue. But it is a health concern. There has been a documented case of dengue in a person in Long Island, and that person never traveled anywhere. Puerto Rico has been experiencing very large outbreaks of dengue every year for almost 20 years. And there's a lot of travelers from Puerto Rico to parts of New York, and maybe this is the cause of that. We don't have the right mosquito vector up here in upstate New York.
We do have the Triple E, and we do have West Nile.
We do have other mosquito vectors, but the one that transmits dengue is basically two types of mosquitoes, Aedes aegypti and Alba pictus. And they really like a warmer environment, and it's just way too cold. That's the only advantage we have up here.
I was going to say, our winters kill them off. Or,
that's right. Scares them away.
So you have had a very interesting background, which we could go into in great detail, but you've done a lot of research over the years in dengue, I know, and are currently doing that.
Right.
But I understand you yourself had the infection. Tell us about that.
Well, I was stationed in Bangkok, Thailand. We have a large overseas laboratory, and that's where I started doing my research in dengue. And so I lived there with my family for about 5 years. And we had a field site in the upper part of Thailand called Kampong Phet, which is studies that are still going on. And we had a very large cohort of children who were following year by year to see just what the full burden of dengue infection was. And we would sample their blood 3 times a year in all 2,400 kids.
Wow.
And during May of 1 year, I was out there sampling blood, and it's very hot. There's a lot of mosquitoes around. Some of these kids are sick with dengue. And unfortunately, I was infected by a mosquito, and I became ill a couple weeks later, which I thought was a bad case of flu. Only it was very, very bad. It lasted for, you know, 3, 4, 5 days of very severe pain and fever. And, of course, I had a dengue lab, and so they ran my blood work and told me that, of course, I had a dengue too, actually.
Wow. But then, of course, you recovered.
I did.
And you have not been exposed again, or you haven't had any problem?
I haven't had any problem. I still continue to do research there. Several times a year I go back for these studies, but haven't had the recurrence of that.
In the little bit of time we have left, I want to get to your current research. So mm-hmm. You are currently right here at Upstate doing research in dengue. Are you trying to develop a vaccine? And if so, tell us about that briefly.
Yeah, in fact, we have a whole group of dengue researchers here now. We are supporting industry to develop a dengue vaccine. There is actually a dengue vaccine trial ongoing now in support of a vaccine by Sanofi, and hopefully there'll be future ones by GSK and others. So we are in need of volunteers to do safety studies, what we call phase 1 studies for dengue vaccines.
We'll have that information on our website mm-hmm. if any of our listeners are interested in participating. So they can go to our HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org, and
we
see.
We have projects in Ecuador right now to look at dengue burden, and also projects that continue on in Thailand.
So you are actively still engaged in this.
Oh, yeah.
Do you foresee that in your career path, your career time, that you will have a viable vaccine?
Yes.
And do you think that we'll be able to stop or reduce the spread of dengue pretty successfully?
I think we'll make a big dent in it.
Well, you know, it's such interesting work. And I guess one very last question, is there other methods of prevention like mosquito prevention that we're actively doing in this country now?
Well, just like they do for Tripoli, they've done aerial spraying, wearing personal protection such as DEET products or insect repellents, getting rid of all the
standing water.
Exactly, standing water around your house. Those are very important measures to do.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Timothy Endy, Chief of Infectious Diseases, and he's an Associate Professor of Medicine at Upstate Medical University and obviously a very significant dengue researcher. Next up, how are local efforts promoting diversity in our healthcare workers? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Healthcare in the United States today must serve a diversity of patients, and likewise, the healthcare system benefits from reflecting that diversity in its healthcare workers. We'll hear with more on this is Dr. Brian Thompson. He's the director of obstetrics at Upstate University Hospital's community campus and the medical director of the Upstate Midwifery Program. In addition to these duties, Dr. Thompson also serves as the assistant dean for diversity at Upstate Medical University. He's also a member of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, American Indian, Alaska Native Women's Health Committee, among others. Welcome, Dr. Thompson. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for this opportunity today.
So you have a very special interest, I guess, in attracting a diverse population for training in healthcare, I guess. Tell us about that.
Yes. Not very known is that the last Native American to enter medical school from our region was actually myself, and that was 23 years ago.
My goodness, that's shocking.
So when you look at that, and you start to elevate and scale up the attention of that, our senior leadership at Upstate have an incredibly tender heart and recognize that. But not only for Native Americans, but also for other populations. When you look at African Americans, Hispanics, and the list goes on and on and on to try to further a diverse population at Upstate.
So that is really your goal, I mean, to increase the numbers of people of color in the healthcare worker field.
Oh, absolutely. When you look at healthcare statistics and the disparity of healthcare of underrepresented populations, it is just what we have to do is to begin from the ground up. And the only way that you do that is by elevating the discussion.
Obviously, I hadn't realized that you are part of the Native American community, so you have that special interest in this population. Do you think that, and indigenous peoples in general, do you think that they have been underserved by the healthcare system?
Yes. When you look at the statistics for per capita healthcare expenditures in the United States, if you look at Medicare, on average per person, the average person spends approximately about $12,000 a year. If you look at Medicaid, it's give or take approximately about $6,600 a year. When you look at people who have insurance, it's about $8,000 a year. When you look at the Veterans Administration, it's about $6,900 a year. But when you look at what services Native Americans, which is the Indian Health Service, it's about $2,850 per person per year.
So it's quite a distinction there.
Quite an incredible distinction of disparity of per capita healthcare costs.
So What would be the result of that? I mean, it seems self-evident as to what the result in terms of their use of the facilities or use of what's available to them, but what do you see as the result of that?
Well, what you see is a health disparity. If you look at just the general statistics, there's approximately about 5.2 million Native Americans in the United States. The average life expectancy for Native Americans in the United States is about 4.2 years less than all other races combined. If you look at the life expectancy, for example, of the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, the average life expectancy of a male is only 52 years old. Or 48 years old. The average life expectancy of a woman is 52 years old, and that's the second lowest life expectancy in the Western Hemisphere. Only lower is Haiti.
So that's pretty shocking and pretty staggering, those statistics, in terms of the impact on the fact that they are underserved, or in a sense either underutilizing or underserved by the healthcare system. What impact do you think an increase in the numbers of people in as healthcare workers might then have?
Will help to decrease the health disparity and help to improve the numbers. I mean, when you look at rates of chronic liver disease and cirrhosis and rates of cancer, violence against women is a huge, huge problem. Not only in Native populations, but for all people and for all Indigenous people in the world.
But if they're currently underrepresented, they're obviously underrepresented within the healthcare worker system at this point. What's your concept of if they were better represented within the healthcare healthcare workers?
Yeah.
How would that impact on the care given or on the utilization of care by these populations?
I think that when you look at the Native population as a whole, you have to look within itself. And the way that you do that is by mentoring youth, mentoring kids in junior high, high school, college, trying to get them into medical school, not only to be doctors, but to be nurses and ultrasound technicians and radiology technicians and administrators. And you start to build a healthcare system from the ground up. When you look at the numbers of Native students who are entering medical school, the numbers are very, very low. They haven't increased over time. They've actually decreased some. So we do have some catching up to do.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Brian Thompson. We're talking about the need for attracting more Native Americans to the field of healthcare, among other things. But there's a piece here that I think you have in mind in terms of if there were more people that looked like them, so to speak, or talked like them, or came from their community as healthcare workers, do you feel that the care delivered or their willingness to accept care would be greater, I guess?
Yeah. And it's not only for Native populations, but if one of my ideas when you look at healthcare, not only in the United States, but you look at things globally, and we really need to look at things globally, is that Native American healthcare on rural reservations or in rural populations is just a template for rural healthcare in the United States in general and around the world. Patients enjoy having role models that are from their own ethnicity, from their own backgrounds. They're able to express their culture and their ideas.
Maybe the trust factor also plays a big role.
Absolutely.
So that perhaps maybe compliance, willingness to come to see the doctor and or mid-level worker to get help would be more apt if they recognized this person as someone they can identify with.
Absolutely.
So, and in your role for diversity, how have you specifically engaged in trying to increase their numbers.
So one of the programs that we're doing at Upstate that I'm very proud of is to look at our youth, all youth of all colors. One of the things that we do that I do is to go into junior high schools, to go into elementary schools, and to go into high schools. And something simple as a program of showing kids, high school kids, how to tie sutures,
wow,
to make suture knots. We essentially teach them the same class that we would teach our own residents in obstetrics and gynecology. And these kids are amazing. They're so smart, and they pick it up so quickly. And it gives them the experience of and the fulfillment of being able to accomplish something that they see on TV, that they see other people do that they never imagined that they would be able to do themselves.
So it's almost a little window into what could be.
Yes. And it's an opportunity to not only attract kids to medicine, to be doctors, but to have kids attracted to be paramedics and EMTs and nurses and operating room technicians and just healthcare in general. So the key is to really get these kids when they're young to go into the junior high schools and the high schools and mentor them and bring them along and show them that there are other people that care about them.
In addition to that, you recently attended the United Nations World Conference on Indigenous Peoples, and you represented Upstate Medical University. What came out of that conference? I understand it was the first one of its kind.
It was a historic conference. It was a United Nations General Assembly meeting. It was a high plenary meeting of world leaders. It was tied with the climate conference that gained worldwide attention. It was 4 years in the planning to just allow indigenous peoples from around the world to even attend a General Assembly meeting. Just an incredible event.
Mm.
Some history of that is that it took approximately 30 years for the United Nations to develop what is known as the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
Wow.
For the world. It is a document of just basic human rights, specifically for indigenous peoples. The question is how you further progress that declaration and to implement it. And part of this conference was to do that, and an outcome document came out of that.
For the entire world.
But
how about
world.
What did you come away with in the little bit of time we have left? How did that impact on what your plans might be going forward?
The idea is to bring all of that energy and all of that ideas and how you incorporate it on a local, regional, and a national level, to further enhance the healthcare of all people.
So it kind of gave you energy to move forward even more.
Yes.
Intensively with the work that you're doing here.
And it also gave the opportunity for Upstate to be able to interact on a global level.
Mm-hmm.
And to develop partnerships on a national, international level, and to work with the United Nations.
Very impressive. Very, very inspiring, too. And I wish you such good luck with this continued effort. I think it's going to only have tremendous impact on our healthcare system overall. I think all of us will benefit. My guest has been Dr. Brian Thompson. He's director of obstetrics at Upstate University Hospital's Community Campus, the medical director of Upstate's midwifery program, as well as the assistant dean for diversity at Upstate Medical University. Great work you're doing, Dr. Thompson. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up, Jump the Hump, or My Secret to Less Pain and More Gain. Well, folks, if you're a regular listener, you know more exercise means more energy. better sleep, getting stronger, lower blood pressure, lower heart rate, reduced chance of breast cancer, colon cancer, diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, and we're calmer, more positive, enjoy sex more, and reduce our chances of premature disability and death. Wow. So right now, I hope you're asking, how am I going to get myself over the hump to exercise more? Well, have I got the answer for you? A cup of coffee. What's that you say, Dr. Neckup? A cup of coffee? Yep. Right when you're thinking of moving the bod a bit more. Why? Because studies show physically the caffeine in coffee makes muscles work more efficiently and gives us energy so we can start moving. And psychologically, caffeine makes moving faster feel less effortful, gives us a jump the hump attitude, and even reduces pain so we're able to keep going a bit longer. How much do we need? You don't need a grande double latte, blah, blah, blah. Just a regular 8-ounce cup of Joe has about 200 milligrams of caffeine, enough to make those good things happen. Now, if you hate coffee, you can take a caffeine pill. One pill has the same 200 mg of the Jolt and Java. Both can be a little hard on the tummy, so maybe eat something with them. Bananas, I find, are great. Even more good news? With caffeine, we can go harder and faster, and in less time, get the same benefits as going easier but longer. Cool, huh? And who doesn't need more time? Worried about it keeping you awake? Well, have it before noon, and your body will burn most of it up by bedtime. In just 8 to 12 weeks, you'll be regularly faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. I'm Dr. Rich, Jumpin' Java Joe O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Next, how a local training program is encouraging more young doctors to return to small-town country practices. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen with your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of November 10th. Deter diabetes. Diabetes is becoming an increasingly deadly problem for adults and youth alike. You can reduce your risk for diabetes by being physically active, eating more fiber, which includes vegetables, fruits, beans, whole grains, nuts, and seeds, by consuming 100% whole grains over refined grains, and maintaining a healthy weight. Make at least one small goal for each day this week that incorporates these guidelines. For example, schedule a 30-minute exercise session or make a whole grain, fiber-rich meal. By focusing on your health earlier, you can prevent the negative consequences of diabetes. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, access to healthcare services is crucial to ensure the good health of all Americans. But access issues are even more acute in the rural communities, which on the whole are experiencing severe professional shortages in the medical field. Upstate Medical University has a program to address this need, and here with more about it is Carrie Rosamelia. She's the administrative coordinator for the Rural Medical Education Program at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Carrie. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So you're involved in this training program, RMED, Rural Medical Education. What is the program? Why are you doing it? What is it about?
Sure. The Rural Medical Education Program brings in interested medical students into medical school, and we provide a clinical experience in rural communities across New York State.
So the idea here is you're trying to promote and develop professional individuals, medical personnel, who would then perhaps have an affinity to going out and working within these rural communities?
Absolutely. We also try to connect with those rural communities before they come to medical school so that we can get some homegrown folks from the area to serve and go back to their hometowns.
So you're literally looking for students or potential students mm-hmm. from these rural communities who would come to medical school and then have a commitment to going back.
Exactly.
So you're really promoting that whole idea. So how does it exactly work?
Sure. So we have an aggressive admissions policy for the College of Medicine where we offer students interested in coming to upstate, not preferential treatment, but we certainly recruit and try to get as many students as we can from rural areas to come to upstate. And we ask that in their third year of medical school that they train, do some of their clinical training in a rural site across upstate New York.
So so it works that during their third year, which is their clinical mm-hmm. year, do they spend all their time in various rural communities? Have they committed when they come in to do only that, or do they have some opportunities to pick and choose?
Okay, so they're committed to coming in, and in the first 2 years of medical school, they take an elective course called the Intro to Rural Health course. They take that with our PA students, our physician assistant students, and we bring in guest speakers from across New York State to talk about issues that are rurally inclined, but also different sorts of issues, women in health. We have a session on the military coming back from war and how that affects the populations and the people that they serve. And then in their third year of medical school, all students, not just the RMed students, they kind of try on their specialties. So they do pediatrics and OBGYN, internal medicine, a whole bunch. They do those five. And then our RMed students in January, they go off and they do the last three clerkships, their last three specialized rotations, family medicine, emergency medicine and surgery in different hospitals around upstate and northern New York.
So they're literally located in those during those three clerkships in rural environments.
Yes.
And it's all around this region.
It is.
Specifically supporting this region. When did this program begin?
So it had its roots in the 1960s, but the RMed program, it's where students spent a week. And some of them chose to work with a family practitioner for a week. But since then, it grew. And in 1989, they established the actual RMed program. That was Dr. Wolf initiated this program. And that's when it took on that clinical component. So this year, we're celebrating our 25th year.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
How many students have graduated from the program? Do you know?
I do know. We've had 215 graduates.
Wow. And have all of them, I don't want to put you on the hot seat here, but have all of them chosen to go back into these rural communities?
No, not all of them. Opportunities are different for each student. About half go back into rural communities, according to some of our data and some of the research out there. They're four times more likely to practice in a rural setting, and they're five times more likely to work in rural New York.
That's wonderful, yeah. Actually. So it that is. Really is, that's really a backbone of keeping some coverage and some involvement in helping to fill this gap and this void out there.
And we've done nothing but expand. So we went from having a handful, five, up to nine. Last year we had 15 students in our program. And this year we're going to have 23 students in our program.
My goodness, that's quite significant. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Carrie Rosamelia. And we're talking about Upstate's Rural Medicine Program, which trains doctors in rural settings in the hopes that they will choose to practice in like environments. Well, Carrie, you recently engaged in a very interesting project, a student photo research project. which illustrated how the students are currently experiencing this program. Tell us about that.
Sure. So we recruited students from our PA program and our medical school program, and we asked them to take pictures thinking of this research question. And the research question was, how does the rural setting impact or influence your clinical learning experiences? So we really wanted to see how this rural setting was affecting what they learned. And we found some really interesting things, but more importantly, we gave the students a chance to provide a voice, their own voice, which is part of the method, photo voice. A lot of people interested in qualitative research are now turning to different methods to provide a voice for the participants to be able to express whatever research question that they have.
So do you mean a voice metaphorically? What I mean is, tell me what did they come back with?
Sure. So they came back with some interesting information about their experiences serving rural populations, living in a rural town, and training their clinical experiences.
What I mean specifically is, what did they physically come back with? Did they come back with recordings?
Oh, yes.
Of other of patients, of themselves and their in their impressions, as well as photographs? Give us a feel for what they brought back to you.
Sure. So they sent to our team, so there's five of us working on this team, they sent through email pictures. So they snapped some photos. On average, they sent in five photos, and they sent in blurbs, or vignettes is what we call them, of what they were describing. So we were inundated with our photos and their blurbs, and we put them on a screen, and the researchers kind of went through and said, what do you think they're saying here? And we grouped them into different kinds of areas and came up with some general themes about what we think these students were saying.
So what did you learn?
We learned that students are connecting in these communities in really engaging ways. So they are talking about seeing families over time. They're talking about really getting to know their patient, which is important if we want these students to end up in these communities. Having that connection to those communities is really important.
It also strikes me as quite a different, almost a different movement as opposed to the forces that are going on in both urban and even suburban environments in modern medicine, where the movement is to see many patients very rapidly and perhaps not get to know people on a long-term basis. And this seems to be flying in the face of that, almost moving in an opposite direction. Does that sound true?
Absolutely. I absolutely agree. So they're working with physicians who know their patients and their fathers and their cousins, and they know the family in a really dynamic way. What I thought was really interesting was talking to students about what their clinical experiences were. So I wanted to know how the setting affected their actual training as future doctors.
And how did it?
They talked a lot about learning a different practice of medicine. So many of the physicians that they worked with, they don't rely on a lot of testing. They feel like patients won't go and get a lot of testing. They rely on their knowledge of medicine and their practice of medicine in a different sort of way. They rely on the knowledge that they have about this person and whether they're going to be compliant with the information that they're giving them. And they're really...
It's almost more in-depth understanding of the context from which the patient comes, seeing their community, their family, mm-hmm. and that informing some of their diagnostic
Absolutely.
Understandings.
They gave a couple examples. One person gave an example of not seeing a patient out walking her dog every day. So knowing that they needed to check on that patient because she was having some knee issues. So checking to make sure that patient was okay, and just knowing their lifestyle really affected how they knew about that person's health.
So what would you say you, as part of this, as a coordinator of this program, took away? What did you learn in terms of the value of the program, or how you might alter it or improve it or just keep going?
Yeah.
What did you learn?
I learned that I would love to expand this program. I think it's important for students who are interested in working in inner cities, students who might be working or interested in global health. This is a a package program that you can take out of the rural setting and use in another setting.
So it's a model for education.
It is a great model. It's a great model. It takes the students from learning components of health. Now I'm in family medicine and here's what I learned. Now I'm in surgery, here's what I learned. And instead seeing a patient through the healthcare system.
In real life.
In real life.
So how did you see, or did you see, the attitude of the patient, of the, not the patients, I'm sorry, of the students change or evolve during this whole process, or during their whole experience with RMED?
Sure. So they went in, you know, I'm with them when they're getting their orientation into the program, and they seem very nervous. But towards the end of it, at least through their voices here in this project, I learned that they really connected to their communities and that they feel very passionate about healthcare.
And rural healthcare in particular, do you think?
We hope so. So I have one quote here from one of our students, and it says, "Most physicians don't grow up in the communities they practice in. Integration into the community is a process, one that can take decades. It brings great rewards, particularly in communities small enough for a physician to have an important identity. Hopefully I can do that as well as my preceptors did." So I think it's interesting that they're seeing the identity of a doctor in a different sort of light.
And they've had a mentor in that environment to see that person be successful in that environment. And that's always very, very helpful.
Exactly.
Well, I want to thank you. Thank you so very much for coming in. My guest has been Carrie Rose Amelia. She's administrative coordinator for the Rural Medical Education Program at Upstate Medical University. Sounds like a very exciting and developing program. Thanks so much for coming in, Carrie.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. In healthcare today, we hear the words quality of life and try to factor it into the equation of healthcare's costs, not just fiscal, but physical and emotional. Peg Johnston, a writer, activist, and photographer from Binghamton, New York, examines this idea in an essay about her brother called Ballast. Words mean a lot to me, perhaps too much, but to be robbed of words would be a poverty I might not be able to endure. I say might because having seen my brother go through the worst and still persist, I think you never know how you'll be. John was a person of few words. He hung back and watched, and then with impeccable timing, he spoke his line with a dry wit that made the rest of us seem like babbling fools. He spent much of his time out in nature, understanding a different kind of language. He fixed things and thought a lot about the right way to fix things. He knew more than anyone about all kinds of subjects, and if you asked him the right question, he could say quite a number of words when he was ready. He would never guess or fake his way through a question, even if he was almost surely right. John's last word to me was ballast. He lived for another 14 months, but his rare brain disorder robbed him of all speech. As usual, I was chattering along, trying to bring cheer and optimism through the sheer force of ordinary conversation. I was failing. I stopped and stared out the hospital window at the asphalted flat roof that was his primary view. You know, I never understood why they put gravel on a roof. After a minute, during which I almost forgot I had posed a question, he said, "Ballast," with great difficulty, but clearly. He watched while I worked out the details that he could not supply. "Oh, right, you mean the weight of the stone keeps the roof from blowing off." He nodded gravely with the tiniest of smiles in his eyes. Throughout the rest of his life, I waited for another word, spoken or written, mimed or puzzled out with all manner of crude and sophisticated technologies. I, who had mastered the open question so useful in counseling, learned the art of the elegant yes and no question. We found ways to communicate, to read nonverbal language, to speak the obvious, to cry. We even pieced together an eloquent appeal to his doctors to find a way to keep him alive when they wanted him to give up. After his death, I realized that this single word, ballast, is his gift to me, a lover of words, like an uncharacteristic rose from one who has always spurned romance. He would say it was just the answer to my question, gravel on a roof. But it sent me to Oxford, to Webster, to Funk and Wagnalls for finer meanings. Now that John has gone, our family is indeed a little off balance, our boat wobbly, but still afloat. It is a truism that you don't know what a thing is without the absence of it. John acted as ballast in our family. He provided the stability and weight, which went unnoticed until he was gone. In the months that followed his sudden collapse, we in turn were his ballast, holding down the corners of his new world as he coped with the puzzle of his disease, the new landscape of frightening and embarrassing medical probing, and a body that would not work. In what was a departure for him, he let us clean him, hold his hand, and read to him. We brought stories, pictures, and bits of nature to him, like a cat with a prized bird eager for his approval. John kept on as long as he could until finally, nearing a home port that only he could see, he began to release the ballast that held him in this life. He took his time, as he always did, letting us go gently and quietly, and leaving such gifts as he could. In my case, a single word.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we take a closer look at how nurses are training to focus on the needs of the growing elderly population. Plus, we'll meet award-winning filmmaker and photographer Carolyn Jones, who's captured the essence of nursing today in America in her work, The American Nurse Project. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Sirio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.